Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. It's been almost 2.5 years since an earthquake and subsequent tsunami caused a reactor meltdown at the Fukushima nuclear power plant in Japan. Last week, the Tokyo Electric Power Company, or TEPCO, admitted that 300 tons of highly radioactive water has leaked from a steel tank in the plant and is seeping into the ground and entering the Pacific Ocean. According to the Telegraph, radiation levels in three of the reactor buildings are so high that it's impossible for workers to spend more than a couple of minutes inside at a time. The general manager of TEPCO, Masayuki Ono, admitted they, quote, found a radiation level strong enough to give someone a 5-year dose of radiation within 1 hour right around the leaking tank, end quote. Japan's nuclear regulator is now questioning TEPCO's ability to deal with this crisis, and the Japanese government says it will now lead what it's calling emergency measures. Nuclear power experts say this crisis is not even close to being over, and it's far worse than we were led to believe. So on today's Your Call, we're talking about what's really happening at Fukushima. What is really going on with the handling of this leak? Who's stepping up to take care of it? Who's at risk if the radiation continues to leak out? And how did this happen? Why is it that 2.5 years later, the Japanese government is now saying that TEPCO does not have the ability to deal with this crisis? Joining us to talk about this is Arjun Makijani. He's president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. He has a PhD in engineering with a specialization in nuclear fusion from UC Berkeley. And he's author of Carbon Free and Nuclear Free, a Roadmap for U.S. Energy Policy. It's an analysis of a transition to an economy based completely on renewable energy without any use of fossil fuels or nuclear power. Hi, Arjun. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me, Rose.
It's nice to have you. We're also joined by Arne Gunderson, chief engineer for Fair Winds Energy Education Corp. That's a nonprofit that educates the public about nuclear power and other energy issues. Arne has 40 years of nuclear power engineering experience. He managed and coordinated projects at 70 nuclear power plants in the U.S. And Arne's also a whistleblower. Back in 1990, he discovered radioactive material in an accounting safe at Nuclear Energy Services in Danbury, Connecticut, the consulting firm where he served as senior VP. 3 weeks after he told the president of what he believed to be radiation safety violations, he was fired. Hi, Arne. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you both. Now, there's so much information going around about Fukushima. So many people don't know what to believe and what not to believe. So before we dive in, I'd like you both to talk about where you're getting your information about Fukushima. Arjun, let's start off with you. Where are you getting information?
Well, from a lot of different sources. Of course, you've seen the press reports, so that's one source. But the press gets its numbers from someplace. So I look at the website of the power company, TEPCO. I also look quite a bit at the website of the French Institute for Radio Protection, the IRSN. So you can go to www.irsn.fr. And if you don't know French, you can put it into Google Translate. They have quite a lot of very useful information, and then sometimes the French press will carry interviews with their leading authorities that reveal more information. I find the French are quite concerned since Fukushima, since they realize that if they have an accident like that, that it would be pretty catastrophic for France. Mm. They are not really moving away from nuclear energy yet, but they're much more concerned than they were before Fukushima.
And are you in touch with anyone on the ground in Japan?
No, we get emails, you know, from people in Japan. So there's a network of people. So I do see information from Japan, but I'm not in constant touch with anybody in Japan.
Okay. And Arne Gunderson, what about you? Where are you getting your information about Fukushima?
Well, like Arjun, the published accounts are becoming voluminous. But there was a group of experts that Arjun and I were part of that spoke at a symposium in New York City on the anniversary of the reactor. No, I'm sorry, I was there, and Arjun, I don't believe you were.
I sent a message, but I couldn't be there.
That's right. You were. So anyway, that group of experts has been keeping each other informed. But lastly, I am getting a lot of information from people on the ground in Japan via email, including members of Tokyo Electric, and also more interestingly, the citizens and medical people in Japan as well.
So let's talk about how this all came about, because I noticed about a month or so ago, there were so many articles about the Pacific Ocean, about fish, about just, and it was hard to kind of, it was hard to find out if that information was factual. And then about 2 weeks ago, we're now getting articles from Bloomberg, BBC, you name it. And now you have TEPCO actually coming out and saying that, yes, 300 tons of highly radioactive water has in fact leaked from a steel plant. So, Arjun, can you just talk about the events and how we got to this point?
Yeah, well, you know, the company knew since May that they have a problem with highly contaminated water, groundwater. So there are two different problems. There's a leak in the tank, which is more recent. But the highly contaminated groundwater has been a known problem for some time, because there's water coming in from above the site, goes through the site, and picks up contamination. And the company knew about this, and they built a kind of a chemically impregnated wall to hold back the water. And sometime a couple of months ago, this wall, essentially like a dam with no evaporation but constant inflow, the water started overtopping the dam, and that's where the 300 tons a day of water estimated to flow into the ocean is coming from. It's different from the 300 tons that leak from the tank. Now, this groundwater is very highly contaminated with strontium-90 and cesium-134 and 137, but I'm especially worried about the strontium-90 because it's much more dangerous in it. It bioaccumulates in algae and fish, and it goes to the bone, and it's more dangerous for human beings and as well as biota. So that's a problem that TEPCO admitted in July, and there was a kind of a indication that they hadn't been forthcoming, which is an old problem with TEPCO. And so the concerns about Fukushima started escalating at that time, and but recently, with the more indications of mismanagement and leaks, not the first time there have been leaks from tanks, they upgraded the accident level on the international scale of accidents from 1, which is really an incident without implications. And I, for the life of me, don't understand how they could ever have rated the continuing problem at a level of 1 to a level of 3. And I think the international scale was not really made for accidents like this. And this is an accident that just doesn't stop, as you mentioned, 2.5 years from now. So there's been a series of continuing problems, and the high radiation rates on site are due to multiple causes. There's a tank leak, there's contaminated soil, there are contaminated buildings. Even the turbine buildings are contaminated and have been. So the workers are being very hampered from doing their jobs of managing the accident and getting the highly radioactive materials off-site.
And again, speaking of the workers, according to many reports, the radiation levels in 3 of the reactor buildings are so high that it's impossible for workers to spend more than a few minutes inside at any given time. And Arnie, can you paint us a picture of what this looks like? Because while I was reading the pieces, they just talk about these tanks, and I'm trying to picture what this looks like. So you've got 1,000 tanks have been built to hold this water, and these are believed to be at around 85% of their capacity. And every day, an extra 400 tons of water are being added. So paint us a picture of what this actually looks like.
The buildings they're removing around 400 tons of contaminated water from the basements of these buildings every day. And they've got to put it somewhere. And their solution has been to build about a 1,000-ton tank. So every 2.5 days, they have to build a new tank. You know, you're talking 3 tanks a week have to be built. this water is being treated, and some of the cesium is being removed. But like Arjun said, the strontium 90 and other isotopes is not. So, let me take your listeners back. You know, when you look at the pictures of Fukushima, these guys are all in, you know, white coveralls with several layers and respirators on and things like that. To give you an idea, I worked refuelings at nuclear power plants, and I didn't have to wear as much clothing as these guys wear when I was standing directly above the nuclear reactor. So, this is highly contaminated ground that these workers are working on, and in large part because it's become contaminated with all this liquid that's been leaking, as Arjun said, not just out of this one tank that made the news 2 weeks ago, but the tank farm in general has been leaking and will continue to leak along with the basements of these buildings.
You know, Arnie, we've got a kind of a bad connection. We're going to try you back on your other line.
Okay.
Thank you. That is Arnie Gunderson. He's chief engineer for Fairwinds Energy Education. It's a nonprofit that educates the public about nuclear power. He's got 40 years of nuclear power engineering experience. He's also a whistleblower. And you can read more about his story. In 1990, he discovered radioactive material in an accounting safe at Nuclear Energy Services in Connecticut. When he told his boss about it, he was fired. We're also joined by Arjun Makijani. He's president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. He holds a PhD in engineering with a specialization in nuclear fusion from UC Berkeley. And today we're talking about Fukushima. This has been getting so much attention in the last couple of weeks. About 2 months ago, it started getting attention in alternative sites. And a lot of people said, well, what do we believe? Well, now it's getting attention in the BBC and Bloomberg, you name it. And last week, TEPCO, the Tokyo Electric Power Company, admitted that 300 tons of highly radioactive water has leaked from a steel tank in the plant and is seeping into the ground and entering the Pacific Ocean. So what are your questions about Fukushima? What have you been hearing, and what do you want to know is actually true? What concerns do you have, and how concerned really should we be? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org, or leave a comment on our website. Arjun, can you give us any more information before we move on about just, you know, how to picture this? What does it really look like on the ground?
Well, everybody's seen pictures of the devastated buildings after the hydrogen explosions in 2011. So what has happened since that time is that they have built quite a lot of infrastructure of three types, basically. They have to cool the molten fuel at the bottom of these reactors, and it has melted through the reactor vessels. So it's lying at the bottom of the reactor buildings, and I think some of it is contacting the groundwater. So they have to keep it cool, and they filter it. So they've had to build a large filtration plant to handle an enormous amount of water. Then they have more groundwater that's contaminated than they can handle. They didn't anticipate 700 tons a day of contaminated water, so that's why they're storing contaminated water in these tanks, because they don't have the capacity to filter it. So the tank that leaked has unfiltered, so far as I can tell, has unfiltered highly contaminated water. So they've had to build that infrastructure.
Well, can I just ask you, 700 tons of water?
Yeah, I mean, 700 tons is about 700,000 liters, about a fourth of that. It's about 180,000 gallons a day.
Wow.
And so about 100,000 gallons of that, or slightly more, is contaminated, can't be filtered and stored. In 2011, when they've had this problem on a much smaller scale, when the turbine buildings were contaminated and the workers were facing high radiation rates, I thought that they should consider buying a supertanker and pumping the water off-site into the supertanker and taking the contaminated water off-site for filtration and management. They didn't do that. I know they received my suggestion because it was sent through appropriate channels and authorities, but they rejected the idea. I still think they should do it because just building more tanks and more filtration capacity and more tanks is an endless problem. It's going to be there elsewhere. You have to filter this water. But if it leaks on site, then it makes all other problems on site extremely difficult. And workers are not able to work properly. They get demoralized. They have to be replaced often. They've had thousands and thousands and thousands of workers involved in this accident management. You can't train that many workers that fast. Mm. So,
And what about the health of these workers?
Yes. Yeah, so now it has come out that many, many workers have had high thyroid radiation doses. Mm. While they say, you know, 2 rem is allowed and that's a limit and it's a safe limit, the accepted science of radiation is that there is no safe limit of radiation. If you get a little bit of radiation, you will get a small risk of cancer. If you get more, it will be proportionately higher. This is not me. This is the National Academies. It has been repeatedly studied here and elsewhere. This is the best available information. So I think the cumulative radiation doses to these workers do indicate that they are at some cancer risk, even apart from the thyroid cancer risk, which is now acknowledged by the authorities over there.
Well, even TEPCO is saying that almost 2,000 people who've worked at the plant face a heightened risk of thyroid cancer, and that's
right.
The operator. Well, we've got a number of callers on the line, so let's hear from Beth in San Francisco. Hi, Beth. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for having my call.
Sure, go ahead.
I'm wondering if there's any definitive answer if it's okay to be eating the seafood from the Washington, Oregon, and California coastline, for example, like the oysters and the salmon. And my other part of the question is do you think the government will start testing the fish that we're buying in the stores?
Well, I think there is testing of the food. I'm not completely familiar with the food testing situation, so there's this caveat. I think the Japanese government has banned fishing off of Fukushima. Mm. It takes about 2.5 or 3 years for contamination to travel across the Pacific. By the time it does travel, the contamination is diluted by many, many thousands of times. I don't think we have any food that we eat that is uncontaminated with radiation. First of all, you should know that, because the entire northern hemisphere has been polluted by atmospheric nuclear weapons testing. So when we talk about cesium and strontium and so on, these radioactive materials are present, and carbon-14, they are present in our food and our water from nuclear weapons testing. So this is adding to it, and so the question is a lot more, is it a lot less, and how much of a risk does it? I don't believe that the radiation levels on the west coast of the United States are, you know, I think the main problem is in Japan. My recommendation has been that the EPA and FDA should be doing thorough testing and making the test results very public and very accessible. I don't think even in 2011 they did a very good job. And I think right now, with so much attention to Fukushima, they really should institute a much more thorough. I'm personally, you know, so it's also, you know, I'm a 68-year-old man. So a pregnant woman has a different issue than a 68-year-old man, different risks. So I think the government should be informing the public, and I think the Japanese government should also be making all of its measurements public. As I said, I've been to the TEPCO website. You can't find this information on their website. It should be published by the company and by the government, because they are the ones who are responsible. All that said, I think the main threat is really in and around Japan, especially on the east coast of Japan.
Well, the other issue is that when you go buy fish or eat sushi, I mean, you don't know where the fish is coming from. You can ask, but most of the time the restaurants don't even know. Arnie, you're back with us, and I wanted I wanted to ask you, because there's a lot of confusion out there. I mean, I'm just looking right now online. I searched for Japan fish, and you've got an LA Times piece that says, scientists to eaters, don't freak out over Fukushima fish. And then I found a piece out of Strait, which is a newspaper in Vancouver, and it says, post-Fukushima, Japan's irradiated fish worry experts. So what should citizens believe here?
Well, I think, you know, Arjun hit it on the head by saying that we need to demand from our government to, one, do the testing in sufficient quantity that you've got a statistically meaningful sample, and two, make that testing public. If they're doing it, we have no knowledge of what the data is. You know, and so I'd ask your California listeners to talk to Dianne Feinstein and Barbara Boxer and get a commitment from our government to get good data on these fish. The fish that are coming out of Fukushima Prefecture were radioactive enough that the Japanese did shut down the fisheries along that prefecture. So about 100 miles of coastline have been eliminated. But interestingly, the most contaminated fish in Japan showed up about 200 miles away, and no one understands the mechanism that fish got so far away from the plant and how that radiation continued. So we really don't know a lot about how far the contamination has spread. So, you know, like Arjun, when I've been in Japan twice in the last year, I won't touch the fish. On the East Coast, we've got this plume of contaminated water gradually working its way across the Pacific. And the good news is the Pacific's a big place, and it does get diluted. But the cesium concentration on the U.S. side is only due to bombs. And the wedge is about 10 times more radioactive than what was in the ocean before from bomb testing. So we are seeing the cesium wedge move across the ocean. Within another year, it's likely to hit the West Coast. Now, is that significant enough to stop eating fish? Unless we have the data, we really don't know. So, you know, my advice is let's push our government to, one, take the data enough. Don't do 200 fish, but do thousands of fish, and let's get some good data, and then make it public, and then it can be an informed decision, which we really don't have right now.
All right. Well, thank you, Beth. We'll take one caller before we go to break. Let's hear from Amber in Santa Cruz. Hi, Amber. Welcome to the show.
Oh, good morning. This is a wonderful show. I'm very glad that everybody is talking about this in this way. I am curious, though, as to why nothing has been done prior to this, and I know that there has been quite a lot of information out, and in fact, Ron Wyden of Oregon went to Fukushima, and Robert Alvarez, the former senior policy advisor to the U.S. Secretary of Energy, went, and also there was a lot of concern from the former ambassador to Switzerland, the Japanese former ambassador to Switzerland, Murata. And people have gone to Ban Ki-moon, and there has been no response. We're spending money on building an atomic clock, but why isn't, you know, the world coming together? I mean, this is, in my estimation, probably the greatest threat to humanity at this particular point. Mm. And why aren't people coming together internationally to solve the problem? We have some wonderful minds. We have some fabulous physicists and engineers.
Well, Amber, I hate to cut you off, but we have to go to break. And I'll get to your question right after the break. And then I'll also ask our guests, Arjun Makajani and Arnie Gunderson, really how serious this is. We're talking about Fukushima. It's your call. And we'll be back after this.
Your call, local public radio. If you have a question, idea, or experience to contribute to today's program, 866-798-8255 is the number to call. That's 866-798-TALK. You can also send email questions or comments to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. We'll discuss coverage of U.S. Forest Service budget cuts as thousands of firefighters are battling the horrific rim fire near Yosemite. The second round of cuts are scheduled to begin in October. A number of firefighters are calling on the White House to stop these cuts. So who's covering this angle? And we'll also talk about the launch of Al Jazeera English. And then on Monday, on Labor Day, we'll broadcast a conversation we had with former New York Times reporter Hendrik Smith about his new book, Who Stole the American Dream? What Will It Take to Shift Power Back to the People? That's on Monday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are talking about what is actually happening on the ground in Fukushima. There's so much information out there. So what is true? What is not? What is reliable? How concerned should we be? And what questions do you have? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. Last week, TEPCO, the Tokyo Electric Power Company, admitted that 300 tons of highly radioactive water has leaked from a steel tank in the plant and is seeping into the ground and entering the Pacific Ocean. According to reports, radiation levels are so high in three buildings that it's impossible for workers to spend more than a couple of minutes inside at a time. And we're talking about this very important issue with Arjun Makajani. He's president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. He has a PhD in engineering with a specialization in nuclear fusion from UC Berkeley. He's author of Carbon Free and Nuclear Free, a Roadmap for U.S. Energy Policy. Arne Gunderson is chief engineer for Fairwinds Energy, a nonprofit that educates the public about nuclear power. He's got 40 years of nuclear power engineering experience, and you could read about his 1990 whistleblowing experience at our website. So what about Amber's call? Arne, why hasn't there been an international consortium convened to deal with this issue, or has there been?
Well, I think the reason is that the Japanese have not asked for it. You know, the population in Japan has been kind of isolated from the true cost of this fiasco. You know, cleaning up the site and cleaning up the prefecture, which is about the size of the state of Connecticut, is going to be something on the order of $500 billion. And right now the Japanese really have not admitted that. And so they're not asking for help internationally. Now that it's affecting essentially the Pacific Basin, other countries are getting interested for their own self-interest, and I think likely will force the Japanese to have a more international approach. You know, Woods Hole has actually been saying that the plant has been leaking for the last year and a half. So this is really, you know, the Japanese have just admitted it in May, but Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute has been saying the ocean level should have been dropping. The levels of radiation in the ocean should have been dropping, and they didn't. So they came to the conclusion last year that the plant was leaking into the ocean and the leaks hadn't stopped. This is not a problem that's going to go away tomorrow.
And Arne, how serious is this? Because you were working on nuclear back when Chernobyl was big news. When you compare the two, I mean, what are we really facing here?
Well, the total releases from Chernobyl are greater than the total releases from Fukushima, especially the airborne releases. But again, the releases into the ocean are about 10 times higher from Fukushima than they were from Chernobyl. And, you know, Chernobyl is essentially stopped, and Fukushima is continuing. So comparing the two accidents from airborne releases, Chernobyl's worse. From liquid releases, Fukushima is worse.
Arjun, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I do agree with that. I want to add one thing, though. You know, as Arne indicated, Chernobyl kind of is stopped, and to the extent that it is not, and I think there's a lot of problems there, it is now a local problem. The contamination that was initially spread around the world during the 10 days of the fire, that is the stock of global contamination. Whereas with Fukushima, we have a continuing peril while I don't agree that, you know, it's sort of the most important threat in the world, there are so many important threats in the world. There's climate change. There's all the wars going on and so on. There are thousands of people dying every day in wars in Central Africa and so on. So I would say that the problem at Fukushima, the central problem at Fukushima, is that the emergency is not over after 2.5 years. So you've got this spent fuel in these pools, and the infrastructure to handle it has been destroyed. So they've had to build all these cranes, and they have to somehow figure out how to get it out of the damaged buildings and store it safely and get it off-site. You've got this molten fuel that has a lot more radioactivity than what we've seen now in destroyed buildings being likely contacted by groundwater. So if the situation on the site worsens, if there's another earthquake, if there's a lot of water that contacts this molten fuel and winds up in the ocean, then you could have contamination problems that are extremely serious, much, much more serious than what we face today. So the problem with Fukushima, one of the big problems, is that the threat and the emergency is continuing and unlikely to fade for many, many years.
Experts actually say that it might take up to 3 decades to gain control of the reactors. Does that sound right to you?
It does, because we have some experience at Three Mile Island in terms of removal of partially molten core. But you have to remember, at Three Mile Island, the reactor vessel was not breached. And also at Three Mile Island, the secondary containment was intact. So it was a much more contained environment in which workers could explore how to handle the situation, and the molten fuel could be extracted. Whereas, as you were mentioning, at Fukushima, the working environment is extremely difficult. The building, the secondary containments have been destroyed. The infrastructure to handle the fuel has been destroyed, and the reactor vessels, the fuel has melted through the reactor vessels. So it's anybody's guess, but several decades is a better guess than several years.
Go ahead. Yes, Arnie, go ahead.
You know, I think Japanese are burning out their workforce by radioactive exposure. And if they choose to knock these plants down in, 10 years or 20 years, the exposure of the workforce is going to be extraordinary. It may be the best thing for Japan to get the water out of the ground, and that's a critical problem for the next decade. And then button up these plants and fill them with concrete and walk away for 100 years. Why are we trying to decommission these plants at the expense of extraordinary exposures to a limited workforce? My position has been for about 2 years now, you've got to stop the leaks to the Pacific. Once that problem is accomplished, it may be in Japan's best interest not to turn this back into a seascape, but in fact to wait until the exposures drop down and perhaps even 100 years from now go back in and do the dismantlement that is eventually going to be required.
Wow. That is Arnie Gunderson, Chief Engineer for Fairwinds Energy Education. He's got 40 years of nuclear power engineering experience, coordinated projects at 70 nuclear power plants in the U.S. Arjun Makajani is president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. He has a Ph.D. in engineering with a specialization in nuclear fusion from UC Berkeley. And today we're talking about Fukushima. Mitsuhei Murata, a former Japanese ambassador to Switzerland, is saying that this situation is so bad that the withdrawal of Tokyo's Olympic bid should happen. And he also says that TEPCO cannot be trusted. He says he's extremely worried about the lack of a sense of crisis in Japan and abroad. We've got full lines. We'll have one open in a few minutes, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Let's go to Max in Berkeley. Hi, Max. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for taking my call and for a very informative program. I'd like you to clarify something. Rose, you mentioned 300 tons, but then some of your guests mentioned 300 tons per day. There is a huge difference, and this thing has been going on for more than a year and a half now. And so I'd like this to be clarified. And from what I understand, that this water is being used once through, so to speak, to cool things down. And the gentleman mentioned that if conceivably they could put the water in a tanker and perhaps process it there and isolate it there and all of that. But that's a huge undertaking. But now I'd like you to clarify that the Japanese government has spent already tens of billions of dollars. I think I read in the French press something like 40 billion euros or 40 billion dollars. It's a huge amount of money.
Mm.
So who can afford that? Is TEPCO paying for any of this? I suspect not. It's the government billing them out. And you mentioned Chernobyl briefly, but at least over there it has been contained. They built a sarcophagus around it, which is crumbling from what I understand, but they are building, making plans to replace it. It's all already underway. So I'll stop here and take your answer of the air. Thank
okay.
you very much.
Thank you so much, Max. So first off, Arnie, who is paying for this? And you mentioned, what, $500 billion?
Yeah. The difference in the 300 tons and the 300 tons per day, 300 tons was from the one tank that got the media's attention. But in fact, the site has been leaking 300 tons a day into the Pacific for well over a year. The question, who's paying for it? The Japanese government has been looking for at TEPCO to pay the lion's share of the cleanup on the site. And the problem is, as I understand from indirect contacts with members of the Tokyo Electric Board, is that they're hamstrung. They don't have enough money to do all the things that need to be done in a timely fashion. Therefore, the right thing to do is for the Japanese government to step in, increase the amount of money to solve the problem. I don't think Tokyo Electric has the engineering skill to solve the problem, but without the money, it really doesn't matter. They're going to not provide enough attention to all of the, Arjun rattled off the list of problems the site faces. These thousand tanks are not seismically qualified. So if they have a severe earthquake, those thousand tanks are likely to fail and drain directly into the Pacific overnight. So, there are much worse problems that could occur unless the Japanese get a sense of urgency and attack this problem, with a degree of speed that it really, really requires.
Yeah, Max, thank you for that 300-ton question, because, Arnie, the reports I've read have not said a day. It just said 300 tons, period.
Yes. Rose,
Arjun?
There are two different sources of water. So the 300 tons period, sort of 300-ton amount that has been talked about in the last few days, is a leak from one tank, and it also breached the sort of wall that was built around the tanks to, like, a small dike to contain the water in case it leaked. All of that has been breached. So that's where the high radiation is for workers, were one of the areas. But the site itself was very contaminated from the accident, and the soil is highly contaminated. And as I mentioned, the groundwater seems to be contacting some of the molten fuel. The turbine buildings are contaminated. And there's a lot of groundwater coming into the site from upstream. This is a mountainous area. So the groundwater on the site is very contaminated. They tried to actually pump the groundwater from upstream so that it would not enter the site, but those defenses have also been breached. And so there's a continual flow of groundwater that has overtopped an underground wall that they had kind of built. And there's 300 tons of groundwater that's very contaminated, that's sort of spilling into the ocean every day. Normally there would be groundwater going into the ocean, but now because it's going through a contaminated site, that many tons a day is contaminated.
What happens when radioactive water goes into the Pacific Ocean? Does it dilute? I mean, can you just walk us through that?
Yeah, there are three different things that happen initially. So the Pacific Ocean, of course, as Arnie had mentioned, is very large, and so there's a lot of there's a significant dilution effect. But there's also some radioactivity that will interact with the minerals and biota in the ocean, and then it will become part of the sediments. So it kind of settles down, and then the sediments get contaminated. and whatever feeds on the sediments or on the biota and the sediments also get contaminated. And then apart, some radioactive materials, and strontium-90 particularly worries me in this regard, also bioaccumulate. So algae bioaccumulate strontium-90, fish bioaccumulate strontium-90, especially in the bones, but also throughout the flesh, and because it mimics calcium. And so since we need calcium, non-radioactive, normal calcium for health, and all bony animals do, this becomes a particular problem because the bioaccumulation can be hundreds of times or thousands of times. So it kind of counteracts that dilution effect. And that's why I think that's one of the reasons I think monitoring of food is very, very important.
Well, we talk about food, but what about like sharks and dolphins and whales and coral reefs? How are they affected by this?
Coral reefs, I don't know. And I think generally marine life or the fish will be affected similarly because strontium-90 will bioaccumulate in fish. I'm not a specialist in this area, so I cannot give you a differential of how it will affect different types of fish. Maybe Arnie knows. I don't.
Arnie, do you know?
You know, the strontium-90 is what we call an HTD, which stands for a hard to detect. And the Japanese are not looking for it. You know, they are quoting numbers as far as cesium, but they're not telling us what the strontium-90 releases are. So that's a problem here. But it when you cook a fish and essentially eat the meat, there's much less strontium-90 in it than there is in the bone. So when you eat a fish with the bone, a sardine or something like that, or when you cook it as stew, that strontium-90 is liberated and is more accessible to your body. So it works its way up the food chain, just like, you know, mercury contamination works its way up the food chain. The top end of the food chain has higher concentrations than the lower end of the food chain.
All right. Well, thank you again for calling in, Max. And we've got just about 6 minutes left, so let's try to get in as many calls and emails as we can. We'll first go to calls. Paul in San Francisco. Hi, Paul.
Oh, hi. Actually, my question's been answered, so I'll say good show, and I'll just throw out another question, which is where does France put the spent fuel for its 80 nuclear power plants? And that's my question.
Well, France stores the spent fuel from its nuclear power plants on site because when it comes out of the reactor, it's too hot. It has to be stored underwater. But after a few years, it sends its spent fuel to Normandy, to a site called La Hague, where they have a reprocessing plant which separates the plutonium, uranium, and fission products. And then they reuse some of the plutonium as fuel. They also discharge quite a lot of waste liquids containing radioactivity into the ocean there in the English Channel. And radioactivity has been detected all the way in the Arctic Ocean from La Hague operations. And the uranium is pretty useless, not very useful for reuse in reactors, and so mostly is also accumulating. So they actually, by doing that, they multiply the amount of waste they have to deal with, although the highly radioactive waste is then put into glass logs. They also have liquid radioactive waste that are very highly radioactive, that have to be cooled constantly, that are stored on site. So that's what they do in France.
All right. Thank you, Paul. Let's hear next from Kevin in Felton. Hi, Kevin.
Hi. Thank you. The question that arises first for me is, considering the fact that the containment buildings, the vessels are breached, that the floors of the structures are breached, what methodology exists to actually reestablish containment of this burned fuel so that they can then control the water leakage that's contaminating the planet? I mean, how are they going to reestablish a seal around this burned fuel?
Well, thank you. According to Bloomberg, one consideration would include fencing off the reactors with what would be the world's longest underground ice wall, which sounds kind of bizarre. But Arnie, do you think that they might do something like this?
Well, then, I think the ice wall is an indication of just how desperate they are for solutions. I think they should dig a trench. Had they done it 2 years ago, the trench would have been smaller and closer, but because the contamination is spreading, they need a trench not to keep the water from going into the Pacific, but to keep the clean water from going into the site. So if they can build a trench between the mountain and the site and pump the mountainside down, in other words, drop the amount of clean water entering the site, at that point they have a chance to get the site under control. But when you try to stop the water from going out, when in fact you're getting up, 300, 400, 500 tons a day coming in, eventually you're going to have a breakthrough. And of course that's what's happening right now on site. We've got the part before the water.
This ice wall requires power to keep the ice, the poor water in the soil frozen. And if they have a power failure, of course, then you have all that accumulated water behind the ice wall.
Wow. I mean, it's 40 meters underground is what this would be.
Right. That's why I've suggested that they should get the contaminated water off the site. Mm. But to the caller's question, the main problem of this molten fuel at the bottom of the reactor, that is going to be much more intractable because, as I said, the infrastructure on the site has been destroyed, and how they're going to get at that molten fuel and actually extract it, at least I have not seen any reasonable solutions to this problem.
We've got a couple emails about nuclear plants in our own backyard in California. Danielle writes, I heard long ago that milk from California cows have higher than normal radiation detected in it. I don't want to buy fish from the Pacific based on what I've heard. What about San Onofre and Diablo reactors built on faults? Should they not be commissioned like yesterday? Arnie, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, San Onofre is decommissioned. The big concern at San Onofre now is the fuel in the fuel pool, and it should be as quickly as possible put into something called dry cask storage. Moving on to the other two units at Diablo, they present a seismic risk that I believe hasn't been analyzed, and hopefully as they go for their license extension to go for 20 more years, the public will have a chance to get their foot in the process and assist the regulators in making a decision that, 40 years is enough. It's time to shut this plant down, too.
All right. Thank you for the email, Danielle. We have another email from Sheila who says, since the disaster 2 years ago, we've never been told the whole truth. I stopped eating seafood from the Pacific right then and shared with my family and friends all I was learning. Most folks don't take it seriously until the government speaks. By the way, one of Obama's first supporters way back when he ran for Illinois state legislator was, yes, you guessed it, the nuclear industry. Now do you understand why we have such thunderous silence on this issue? As I said, Arjun, this is now getting more attention in most national media. But what are your thoughts about Sheila? I mean, a lot of people have been wondering, why aren't we hearing more about Fukushima?
Well, I don't think there's a conspiracy about it. I think the press did a pretty fair job of reporting the accident, and those reports did go on for a few months. This particular accident has stretched on for years, and there's so many problems in the world. And I think recently, when there have been reports or indications that the problems are getting worse, and I think that they are, there's been quite a lot of coverage. So it's different. I would say the press should be separated from the administration in this regard. I really don't understand, given the level of public concern on the West Coast, why the administration has not acted with more alacrity in terms of food testing and water testing. Even in 2011, when the EPA did some water testing and so on, I don't think they did a very good job. They did detect radioactivity, but they never tested for water and milk in the same places, to my knowledge. At least I didn't see any results in public.
Arnie, did you see anything?
No. The independent testing, the best independent testing, is done by somebody named Marco Caltofen in the Seattle area. And right after the accident, using air filters, he discovered that for about a month, people were breathing in about 10 hot particles a day from Fukushima Daiichi that were lodging in people's lungs. That report was presented to the American Public Health Association back in October of 2011. That's the best science that I'm aware of right now.
So we've got just 2 minutes left. Like I said, there's so much information out there. What should we do to figure out what is true and what's not? And then what can we actually do about this, Arjun?
Well, you know, I would collect information from many sources. I would not ignore the company's website. They have an English website. You can go there. As I've said, I go to the French Radiation Protection Agency's website. There are many people in Japan. You can get on the email list that Arnie was talking about from that conference earlier this year and get information from activists in Japan. I think MIT actually had at least a project of collecting radiation readings on the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and compiling them. I haven't looked recently to see if they've published them or what the latest status of that is. So I would, you know, there are many sources of information that are reasonably reliable, and you can sometimes fill in the gaps of what is not there by inference. But there is quite a lot of good information out there.
Yeah, and we'll put those links on our website. And 30 seconds, Arnie, what can we actually do about this?
First of all, we can lobby our legislators to get some decent testing. But the second thing is, I think we can lobby the U.S. Congress to put the pressure on the Japanese to replace Tokyo Electric. We need a real engineering firm with an adequate budget to tackle this problem, because it's going to continue for decades to come.
That is Arnie Gunderson, chief engineer for Fairwinds Energy. He's got 40 years of nuclear power engineering experience. Arjun Makajani is president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, author of Carbon Free and Nuclear Free. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we will definitely continue following this issue. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of the U.S. Forest Service budget cuts as thousands of firefighters are battling the massive rim fire near Yosemite. The second round of cuts are scheduled to begin in October. Who's covering this angle? We'll also talk about the launch of Al Jazeera America. We'll be joined by Think Progress's Katie Valentine, CJR's David K. Johnston, and Murrow College's Lawrence Pintack. Where did you see the best reporting this week? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.